Telecast, the TV industry news review.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to this week's Telecast. It's a distribution special this week as we welcome Ruth Berry, Managing Director of Global Distribution at ITV Studios, alongside Jonathan Ford, Managing Director of Abacus Media Rights. Peter White from Deadline Hollywood joins us with all the latest news on this year's Emmy nominations. And K7 Media's content clairvoyant Gertz Leasis looks at the present and future of content distribution. It's been a really busy news week in TV, and there's been a lot of developments on MIPCOM and the UK's Emergency Production Insurance Fund since we recorded the show. We'll be going into those in much more detail next week. But in the meantime, sit back, tell everyone you're busy, and check out this week's Telecast. My guests on the show this week are two of the best-known executives in content distribution, but they're both running very different types of business. Ruth Berry is Managing Director of Global Distribution at ITV Studios. During a period of rapid growth for the entertainment industry, last year, Ruth led ITV Studios' distribution business to record growth, with a leap of 14% in revenue to £217 million. In addition to a day-to-day role and board member responsibilities for BritBox US, Ruth has also become co-chair of ITV Able to lead the charge in creating more equality for the disabled people working in the British TV industry. And joining Ruth is Jonathan Ford, another extremely experienced television and film sales executive, having managed the content sales teams at Q Media Distribution and Content Media. He's now the managing director and board member of the newly formed Abacus Media Rights. So welcome to the show, Ruth and Jonathan.
Hi, Justin. Great to be here. Thank you.
Hi, Justin.
So Ruth, let's start with you, if I may. ITV Studios is one of the top five UK content distributors, helping create global hit shows such as Bodyguard, Love Island, and War of the Worlds. I guess there's been an industry assumption that distributors have been reaping the benefits of this market turbulence we've all found over the last 4 months, with broadcasters snapping up loads of content to plug the gap left by production shutdowns. Has this been your experience over the last sort of three, four months?
Yes and no is probably the right answer, in that we felt the turbulence too. I feel a little mean saying we've reaped the benefits, because it's been, you know, a turbulent time as well as a distribution business, but we have been faring very well. I think as a bit of insight into that, we have got a workforce at home, the same that our buyers and the broadcasters have. And I think the same way that broadcasters have seen a huge amount of change in their schedule, as have we to our pipeline as a distribution business. However, I think there's two things that have really helped underpin our ability to work through the turbulence the best we can. One of which is having had a really strong, agile workforce. And I couldn't be more proud of the team and the way that they've responded to working from home and dealing with their clients and managing, you know, a really difficult time, I think, both professionally and personally. And then I think the other big piece for us is having a huge catalogue. And I think that we can't underestimate the value. I feel very fortunate being part of ITV Studios and having that catalogue. There's about 46,000 hours in there. And that covers a huge range of content and programming, whether that's from the soaps that we have a huge amount of content for. I think the evergreen content that you'll see coming from the likes of Marples and Poirot's and Vera and thousands and thousands of hours of film. So it's sort of it's hard to remember really what life was like, I think, pre-March, and just where all of this turbulence has come from. The other thing I've really found useful for us over the last few months is being close to a broadcast business, because it's amazing how much we've learned from our colleagues on the broadcast side as to that the turbulence you refer to and what impact that's had on broadcast businesses. And it's been very similar for our clients around the world, you know, and as a global business, it's been fascinating as well, seeing that domino impact as the virus has spread, just quite how it's followed that pattern around the world. And I think what we're seeing now in particular somewhere like Latin America, who are seeing a lot of their spikes and their wave of COVID increasing, you know, is when you start to see the market get quieter, but yet you'll see Spain and Italy bounce back. So I think it's been a really fascinating few months for sure.
When you looked at this at the beginning, presumably you sat down and thought, okay, how is the market going to react to this? We haven't really been through anything similar to this since 2008. I thought this is going to be a really good time to be a distributor and a bad time for being a producer. Is there anything that surprised you about the change in demand, or has that not really quite happened yet? Do you still see the big effect in buying behavior change going to be sort of over the next 3-4 months?
The patterns are changing all the time, and they're changing geographically as people get a better sense as to what is next for them. And I think, you know, we often talk about the new normal, and the new normal is also a moving feast, but it's fast becoming normal as opposed to the sort of crisis management it felt like at the beginning of COVID back in sort of March, April. I think what we saw quite early on was a shift in programming, in that there was a lot of news and current affairs, and broadcasters were dominating their schedules with local news and information around the virus and what that meant, and information around lockdowns and what, you know, they were sort of planning for the nation and the safety and all the medical side of what was actually happening. A lot of broadcasters held back their dramas or some of their bigger flagship shows whilst, you know, that messaging was really at the forefront of their schedules. As we saw the COVID fatigue sort of set in, and people didn't want to be reminded on their TV screens every day about what was happening out there, we saw a real lean in towards more feel-good programming. So there was a lot more demand really for comedy and lighthearted drama, which, you know, we then sort of tailored towards that demand. And then a lot of repeats. I think as people realised the extent of the issue on the production side and quite how long it might take to get new shows or productions back up and running, suddenly the schedulers at all of those channels are looking at their sheets in front of them and saying, oh, actually, hang on a minute, this is where the gap's going to be, and it's heading towards autumn, and what do we do over the summer? And so I think it's been a real conundrum for the schedulers, who are looking at, one, what do they have? How much do they repeat? What are the audiences actually wanting during this time? Because the audience is more fickle, I think, than normal. And then it's coming back to the distributors and looking at what the distributors have that they can then acquire. And that's oscillated over the months, and again on a geographical footprint, because it's been different for everybody, and different people had different stock, or they've got slightly different audiences and demographics. From our side, I've certainly seen an enormous amount more work go into curating the catalogue, digging deep into shows that we've got, and how you bring them to the forefront, because many of our clients and partners are buying shows that they wouldn't ordinarily have bought, because they're having to go broader and deeper and really look at what they can put on their schedules for the audiences.
Now we're finding perhaps, and this is an assumption, you've got 45,000 or more hours. Is the options for broadcasters, are they kind of running out a little bit now? I mean, how are you going to deal with that supply drying up, both in factual and drama, of new content?
It's a question I get asked a lot, which is, you know, how long can you function as a catalogue-only business for, you know, with the level of success that we've been having so far in the last few months? And again, the volume that we have is really, we're really fortunate, and we are able to curate a lot out of that catalogue. And there's shows that have got a proven success rate. And I think that's also really important for our buyers, is there is a real depth of long-running returning series that actually can work really well on their schedules, that has an abundance of availability. So the sort of evergreen shows that we have, and Poldark, Marples, Vera's, are really doing well in the current period. On the comedy side, shows like Schitt's Creek and Brassic, which has just gone on to its new season for Sky, have been absolutely brilliant. And we've certainly seen more demand in that space. And clients who haven't necessarily taken things before are taking those types of shows. So I think what we've found is that by having that wealth of catalogue, people will buy shows that have been up maybe on the periphery of their choices before, which is working really well. And then I think we were really lucky as well that we had quite a few shows that were pretty much in the can ready. So if you think about a premium drama like Little Birds, which launches on Sky imminently, you know, that was in post-production. Singapore Grip, likewise, you know, a fantastic British period drama for ITV made by Mammoth Screen. And we've had quite a few titles that were ready to come to market and so will come as new. So we're also benefiting from the fact there are new premium first run titles in our portfolio that are being made available to the market now, which help eke out that period of time whilst things get back up and running into production. And then on the non-scripted side, there's been some really strong documentaries, factual programming. We had shows like Wild Tokyo, Wild Carnatica, voiceovered by Attenborough, that again were in the can. So we've been able to go out with a mix, those new and library shows to the market, which has been really useful.
What about the next 6 months? Because I think everybody's probably expecting the effect to be felt through autumn and into winter. How do you expect buyer behaviour to change then?
That's definitely a key question on my mind as we're thinking about how we go into the next 6-12 months, and timeframes feel shorter than ever at the moment, I think, because there's just so much change. My view is that it's really important for us to stay close to our partners and stay on the journey together. So it really has been a pretty epic journey in the last few months. And over the next 6 months, we'll continue to do that. It's going to be interesting to see how our buyers respond themselves to the challenges that they face. And I think for us, it's about being as adaptable and as agile as possible. My big sense is that, as in the last few years, a lot of broadcasters have moved to more of a local production schedule. We know, and through our production side of the business, you know, we've been growing that off the back of broadcasters looking at more localized schedules. I think it might become harder for them to afford so much local content, and I think they're going to have to balance that more with acquired content and international programming. I think for us, dovetailing that at a time when there's less US content available in the market because of you know, those US studios launching their own SVOD services. Obviously, there's been a challenge in the pipeline of getting movies, big American movies, into the broadcast world. I think so. I'm feeling optimistic about space for distribution businesses to have really strong programming that will fit into the sort of the new design of schedules for those broadcasters, who I think will lean into strong international drama. We're actually back up and running, for example, in France with Balthazar coming from Berberg Stories. Cat Leia in Italy are back up and running in production, already delivering us Italian drama. We've been back into production in Denmark on a show called Equinox, which they've been back finished and wrapped, which is actually for Netflix. But there's going to be some great international drama focus. I think there's going to be a lot of focus as well on key brands and formats, and those proven successes of formats. And for us, I think that's things like The Voice, Come Dine With Me, Love Island, and broadcasters really focusing on the tent poles and looking at where they can derive most value from their schedules. The next 6 months for us is going to be about really finding the way to adapt with our buyers and continue on the journey with them to find the shows that work well for them, that we can continue to put onto their schedules.
Is it sustainable to continue in this way, do you think? I mean, how has not being able to meet physically changed the sales process for you?
I think it's been quite hard and frustrating. I think we're a really lovely industry, and people genuinely have very long-standing relationships and friendships and care quite deeply for each other. So I think there's been a real worry for people's health and livelihoods, and I think that's the warm and fuzzy side of why we love what we do. So I think people genuinely miss each other, and not being able to see each other is a challenge from that sort of emotional perspective. I think from a business perspective, we've been able to cope really well. And I think you just adapt to the fact that a video is how you now communicate. I'm sure my eyesight is getting significantly worse, thanks to it. But, it's how we do business now, and we are effective in doing it. So, you know, it sort of has to be sustainable for as long as we need to be operating in this way. We've been able to operate well this way. I know that, you know, I think in the month of June, we closed over 100 deals, at least in a month, which, again, if you had asked me 6 months ago, would that be possible with everyone working from home? I think I would have looked at you really strangely. But it's the reality now that we can do this. However, you do miss the nuances of those relationships. And every now and again, you know, we creep out and we do meet each other face to face. And I think when you're in territory, it's really useful, where we've got sales teams in territory. They are starting to meet the buyers face to face, and they'll take that trip to Paris and obviously in the UK or in Italy, Germany, the US and other places. And I think once you do see people face to face again, you realize how much you've missed. So it's going to be a fine balance over time, because it's not going to be quick that we all get back to see each other. But we are a pretty big FaceTime industry. We can operate without it, but I definitely miss it.
Do you feel this has sped up the sales process or slowed it down?
Depends a little bit on where. I think in markets that have quite a hierarchy and established approval process, so if, you know, I pointed towards Asia, India and Asia, China in particular, I think it slows it down, because it's much harder to get through all of the hoops to get to the end of a deal. But in the markets where you've got, you know, Western Europe, the US, where you're all pretty used to trading and you've got a rhythm, it's the same as it was before.
I was going to ask you if you're attending MIPCOM. We've seen this week that you've announced your own event and you're not going to be attending MIPCOM. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're really excited. So we're extending our festival success that we've had for the Formats Festival and the Drama Festivals early in the year in February into the Fall Festival across 3 weeks in September, October, later this year. So we've really wanted to try and find an environment for us to still meet with clients and find a sort of a condensed period of time where you can ask clients to commit to spend some time with us and create, you know, a virtual marketplace, because that's what we miss the most, is being able to have those key points in time where you know you're focused on selling. And for the sales team, you know, we have a ITV's financial year is the calendar year, and they're all really focused on, okay, what does that mean for us? How do we still transact with our clients and be able to deliver them sort of immersion into our content to make those sales? So it's the sort of market meeting section of that is really going to be quite key for us, and helping immerse our clients in these great brands, and back to sort of what I was saying earlier about how I think the buying patterns will change, is just making sure for us that we've showcased the portfolio the best way that we can, to help dovetail into what the buyer's needs are going to be over the next 6 to 12 months.
How do you see the pandemic shifting the wider industry going forward?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of trends that we've all been keeping an eye on over the last 12, 24 months that we will see accelerate as a result of the virus impact. I think the consumption patterns have rapidly moved over the last, 4 to 6 months. And when you think about the pivot of viewers across into SVOD, for example. You think about now whether there's a change in how many subscriptions each household will take. I think the unmatched viewing that's happened on a global basis on TV sets as people have also immersed themselves into gaming. I think there's a lot of consumption change as people have been at home and living in a different way. I mean, I certainly notice just how many things I do differently to my house now. I'm here all the time and I'm not traveling and in the office. And I think people's ways of living have changed and therefore how they consume TV, film, gaming is really going to impact what happens next for your TV set and what that means for platforms, broadcasters, content consumption, social media over the coming couple of years.
Jonathan, coming to you, thanks for joining us. You've set up a whole new distribution enterprise pretty much entirely in lockdown, which is a huge achievement. Can you take us through the structure of that new business and how you put it all together under the confines of lockdown?
I was fortunate that actually the business was pulled together just before lockdown. So officially, the launch date was March the 15th. That's when everybody who works for me started working with me and when we officially launched the business and signed all our contracts, as it were. So we had 1 week as a business before lockdown it hit. But, you know, when I chose to leave Q at the end of January, beginning of February, I then spent sort of that time in February talking to a variety of parties about what the opportunities were for me, whether in other organizations or actually doing something on my own. And there's an investment company called Amcomri, who I've known for some time, and they were keen to find a way to work with me on a TV business side. They already had an investment in a very strong film business called 101 Films as a, both a UK and an international business, but they wanted to get into the TV distribution, pre-sales, financing, co-production world. So, you know, I spent the sort of weeks of February agreeing a model to work with them, and that sort of came together at the beginning of March, and I brought in a focused small team, and we launched on March the 15th. And so, basically, Amcomri are investors in Abacus and, you know, helping us finance what we're trying to do here. But, you know, during that period of time, I also was talking to a number of partners in the producer world, many of whom I'd worked with before, some of whom who had existing programming coming through to delivery, which needed representation. So we were sort of able to launch with a number of titles that were already just delivering and available to sell, as well as a number of titles that were in a stage of production where the virus impact was less. So there might have been some delay, but not really too much delay because they're in post. We didn't actually really announce the business till April because we want to make sure some of the sort of key representation relationships, such as working with Dan Reed, people like that, were sort of Sienna Films as well, were sort of there and announced and ready to announce. But, you know, we were operating from just before lockdown.
And you spearheaded international sales on some huge titles, such as mega hit drama Line of Duty. You mentioned Dan Reed's Leaving Neverland earlier on, and factual series as well, such as Killer in Plain Sight. And you've built a really impressive new slate with producers, including Frantic and Dan Reed. How much of an issue does the production shutdown pose for you as a new business? How does that affect you without such a huge catalogue to fall back on?
It obviously impacts. As I say, we were fortunate to work with a number of producers who did have titles that were already delivering. So we do have finished programming to sell and put there out in the market. A lot of the business we've been doing has been pre-selling and setting titles up. Where there may be a commission or a series of pre-sales can get something funded and put together. And, you know, there's an element of risk there because we need those titles to deliver. And, you know, without a doubt, some of them have had and are suffering delays. A lot of them that we're working on at the moment are in the unscripted space, which, you know, is easier to sort of produce within a controlled environment, a virus environment, than drama. And so they may be producing slower, but they are definitely moving ahead. But what we also did is we sort of created a number of partnerships with suppliers, producers, other parties where we could get access to an existing catalogue to sell. So one of the things we're doing is we're representing a range of the documentaries that Gravitas Films from the US control the distribution rights for. We're representing them and selling them around the world. So we have a strong slate of documentaries. We're actually working with Quiver, who bought some of the old Q library to help sell some of the titles that they now have the rights for around the world. So there's an existing library to sell there as well. So and there's a couple of other relationships like that where individual producers have come back to us with titles that may have fallen out of queue or out of other businesses and needed representation. And if we see the opportunity there, we can do a good job on them. We're taking those on. So we've sort of, you know, pulled together a number of finished programming streams of supply, whether it's library, to help supplement the new programming that we're investing in and we have coming through, both in the drama and in the unscripted space.
You mentioned Q. You ran a very successful sales business during your time there. What lessons have you learned from your experience at Q over the years? What lessons do you take from your time there into Abacus and your new venture?
There's a huge amount of lessons there. I mean, obviously, the unfortunate demise of that business, and particularly Q Media Distribution, through no fault of its own as a business, due to issues elsewhere within the parent group and the financing of the parent group. You know, that's certainly one of the attractions to now being in a business where I'm sort of helping run it alongside my investors, because, you know, the ability to be more actively involved in the decision making to make sure the right decisions are being made is certainly something that's appealing. What I've gone is from one sort of medium-sized independent to obviously something that's a very small independent. So many of the sort of approaches to the sales environment, which we had at Q and I assisted on at Q, are over more important now, which is responsiveness to clients, which is that flexibility in how you work with clients. There are some very significant distribution players out there who you have to compete with, and you're never going to be able to, you know, completely compete with them on every level because of their scale and financial scale and size. And so it's how else do you compete? And that's by providing that boutique focus service on specific titles, which, you know, get added focus maybe and added visibility through a smaller distribution entity. Being communicative and responsive to producers, you know, so not just making sure that reporting's on time, but you're involving them and making them understand the sales strategy that you're taking for a title in different territories, you know, so they feel that their title is getting the sort of support and drive and love that it deserves, and that then brings them back to want to work with you again. Similarly with buyers, as I say, being responsive and being flexible and, you know, trying to move everything fast to meet their needs so that they understand that, yes, there's certainly those big volume players who are always going to be very significant in their business, but also those smaller, more boutique players have a role to play as well by helping supplement that volume business and give them a wider range of interesting titles, as it were. When I was at Q, I always had this thing that if you receive a communication from a buyer or supplier, you have to respond in a certain period of time. You have to make sure that you're showing that responsiveness. And that becomes even more important as you try and rise above, rise ahead in this sort of distribution role as a small indie. You know, the cost of making programming is increasing now as a result of the virus, particularly because of the insurance costs added on top and, you know, delays in filming and filming taking longer to make sure that everything is adequately protected. So those costs are increasing, but at the same time, you know, frankly, the means of the buyers is somewhat reduced, particularly those who rely very much on an advertising sales model for revenue. So their budgets are reducing or freezing, and what that means, they're potentially buying less, or if they are buying the same amount, they're being very much more selective about what they buy. And also the rates at which they can buy it are somewhat reducing. So you have an interesting dilemma where the cost of production is going up, but what people can pay for titles, particularly in the distribution world, is reducing. And so how do you make that gap up? You know, and for an independent distributor, you know, it means you've got to be very careful about what you're taking on, making sure that you are certain in your estimates and your forecasts. And also that, you know, looking at alternative models and seeing if producers and commissioning channels are alternative to are open to alternative models, where it may not be, hey, here's an MG for distribution. It may be, look, you know, we can help try and set this up in a couple of other places that ensure the budget is met and the full financing is met, particularly with these additional costs that are now being incurred, as it were.
And the production financing aspect, is that more important now from in your role at Abacus that it was at Q? I mean, putting these deals together and bringing broadcasters together, because I imagine pre-production and co-production partnerships are going to be more important than ever. As you said, there's going to be lots of broadcasters with less money, but still the same amount of hours to fill on their schedule. So presumably co-production is more important than ever it has been before.
Yeah, and I think this probably applies to distribution businesses of every size. The world of pre-selling and setting up co-productions is becoming increasingly important across scripted and unscripted, whether it's me or a bigger independent or anybody else. You know, the idea that you just pay a big MG and that's the financing complete is no longer really viable. You have this amount of money coming from this territory, but you have this gap. How can we get that set up and elsewhere and that gap filled, and those partners all come in and then you go out into the market with it? In some cases, it's even a model that you may not have one pure commission. You may have 2, 3, 4 pre-sales at a slightly reduced rate compared to a normal commission or co-production. So it actually gives better value to that the originating channels because they're paying less than they would do for a pure commission. But then you're getting 3 or 4 of those to pull together to get a production financed and made. So yeah, that's becoming increasingly important to us, you know, both knowing, you know, which channels will consider those type of models or pre-selling and pre-buying into something, but also understanding what other financing partners are out there who may come in and fill gap on a producer's production, you know, and take an element of that gap away and as a financier rather than as a pure sort of channel buyer, as it were.
Is being a distributor more time intensive now than it ever has been?
I've never known it not be time intensive, to be honest. And I think my wife will tell me that she's never known me not be working very long hours in this business. Setting up your own business, it is extremely time intensive, and I don't think that just applies to distribution, it applies to production and the other side, because there's elements of the business which I had awareness of but, you know, was not as deeply involved in, you know, the sort of operational, financial, accounting, that type of thing, which obviously you need to be far more aware of when you're sort of in a small business that you're the managing director of. With a market that is more cautious and understandably more cautious in the buying world, it was more cautious anyway before the virus, as you saw these structural changes with, you know, the strength and growth of SVOD and the premium pay subscription platforms and the reduction of viewing in some of the sort of more basic and free DTT channels. That meant there's more caution within the buying market anyway, and that's obviously been accelerated by the virus, which means that, frankly, you know, there's a lot more conversations to be had and a lot more discussions to be had before a deal is done, a sale is made, you know, before a lot more convincing of channels that this is the right title before they commit themselves, you know, and a lot more, again, sort of thinking slightly out of the box at how to make the deal work for all parties involved, as it were.
Do you think that the next 6 months, things are going to speed up much more in terms of, you know, channels and platforms working out that actually we've got a lot of time to fill and not enough programming? I mean, quite simply, is the supply and demand balance going to shift, do you think? I mean, are you going to see a bit of a gold rush over the next 6 months?
I don't think a gold rush is the right phrase. And I think obviously distribution entities which have that sort of established large libraries, which remain popular and have always been popular, there'll be certainly strong opportunities to fill gaps with those libraries where, you know, they've got those established multi-episode brands. I think what I'm seeing in the market is the premium pay and SVOD guys who have their sort of very specific high-end style of programming that they're looking for, they're not really deviating from wanting that programming. And I don't think they're necessarily going to compromise what they're looking for just because some of it may not be available straight away. The linear channels have had a concern from March onwards about, okay, what are those gaps that they're going to be facing? And there was certainly a big research piece by all channels about, okay, what is out there finished for if these gaps do emerge. I think what you're seeing, particularly again with those ones who suffered from the ad market not being as strong as it was previously, is they've certainly done that research, but at the same time they have faced, you know, budget slowdowns or cuts or freezes. They've done that research. They are worried about the gaps, but they're also having to be very selective about what they invest in to make sure they're getting the return on the more limited budgets that they have. And they are utilizing far more the secondary runs that they have within their existing licenses on existing product. I think a lot of people waited. They did their research, but they waited till really about now, July, August, coming into September, to see whether things will start unlocking on the production side. I think, you know, with some of those guys, they are seeing production unlocking, and so they aren't going to panic buy, as it were, and they haven't needed to panic buy. But they now know what they're going to be getting production wise for the rest of the year, and what is still a gap to fill. So I think coming to September onwards, we will see people being more active in buying to fill the gaps that they now more carefully understand. I'm certainly seeing some cases, particularly in North America, where people may have been holding off making a decision on a finished title, where they're now coming back into the market and say, look, we now understand our position, we'd like to engage with you on that finished title. And I think we'll see more of that across the next few months as they've completed their assessment. They sort of feel they know where they are and the gaps that they're now going to face.
Coming on to MIPCOM, which is obviously that key point in the year that the industry traditionally sales processes revolved around. Will you be attending this year as Abacus?
We secured a stand space, but obviously we, like many other distributors of all sizes, are waiting to see actually what happens. I don't think, you know, the final go-ahead from even Reed Medium's perspective is till around the 1st of September, whether they actually will definitely be running it in whatever form that they expect. We have a space secured. Whether we attend will very much depend on what the rest of the market is doing. And frankly, you know, it worries me significantly that I can't see there being any real North American buyers attending or sales companies or Latin American with, you know, what's going on over there at the moment with this sort of virus increasing. So I have my doubts as to whether the market will exist in its current planned form. But, you know, for us, it's very much a wait and see.
Ruth, your story of the week concerns the green shoots of recovery in production that we talked about earlier. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'm an eternal optimist, so I love anything that's got positivity that gets us back on track. So I think it's great that we're starting to see a way forward. I think, you know, we had some really good early green shoots with some of the soaps, led by one of my favourites, obviously, with Neighbours in Australia a few months back. And I think from there, things have grown, confidence has grown, and people are really focused on when we get started. There is such a brilliant sort of collaborative and sort of a teamwork camaraderie within the industry of people just wanting to be back in production. And whether that's for whichever broadcaster or platform, you know, it's just this fantastic amount of goodwill and energy going into trying to get us there and get cameras rolling. And across all genres, I think it's a particular challenge for drama. I really do. And there is so much work going into that. I think innovation. And I've always loved the sort of notion that necessity is the mother of invention. And, you know, what will come out of this period of time as people try and rise to the challenge of how do we get around that issue, or how do we get around that sort of distancing, and how do we film with particular quadrants or close cohorts? And I think it's really fascinating. So I'm really enjoying reading about those stories, and something like Sex Education going back in production is a personal cheer from me, because that's exactly the sort of show that I think I would like to be watching at the moment and looking forward to the next season. But also the entertainment shows, things like MasterChef, you know, it's great to see the energy in that. And I think there's a level of collaboration across the industry I've not seen in this way before, which I really love. I think it's just brilliant, and again, a testament to the industry that people are working so closely together, coming up with guidelines to make sure everyone stays safe. And then the sort of the trends that will emerge from this, and whether actually best scenario is to focus a bit more on domestic drama for a while so that things can be a bit more contained. What will it mean for episode lengths? Have we seen a huge amount more writing happen during this period? And actually, we'll be able to work through drama quite quickly, sort of COVID. So I think there's a lot of things coming out of it that just really excite me about how things will be done differently and how that could well sort of move the industry on, proliferate everyone's learnings. And I'm going to go for the silver linings out of those stories.
Yeah, let's absolutely keep all of our fingers crossed on that and production being able to continue safely. And actually, we spoke to Dermot Horan from RTE a few weeks ago, and he was talking about normal people and shows such as that that have been able to be produced remotely, domestically. He was thinking that domestic drama from all over the world could actually really start to see a bit of a resurgence now, as opposed to more international shows. So that's going to be really interesting to see. Jonathan, your story, unsurprisingly, is related. And this is about UK production in particular.
Yeah, I mean, basically what I was picking up on here is, it's related to how we get all this production restarted, which the whole industry is reliant on for success. You know, the production, distribution, the channels themselves. And it's, you know, this seeking the government support to get this insurance fund on to actually back the insurers to back these productions and get them running again. Now, it's very, very clear that no production can restart without COVID insurance. And, you know, some of the increases in costs that I'm hearing about from production just simply to be able to cope with the COVID environment, I'm hearing 20, 25% increases in budgets as a result of the additional costs of, predominantly insurance, but also obviously changing the way people work. It's just the story that, this pact and John McVeigh certainly leading the charge in trying to push the government to providing this fund to underwrite insurance companies to provide cover for coronavirus. And the unfortunate issue that we are facing delays on this fund getting in place, partly linked to the fact that during the Brexit transition, we are still reliant on EU approval. But it's a frustrating thing to see that, you know, this is moving so slowly, because this industry, all aspects of this industry, needs this fund in place as soon as we can. And I, you know, just talking to a range of producers that, you know, I work with closely, the cost of this insurance is very strong. And hopefully a fund like this will help bring that down or encourage the insurance companies to be a little bit easier with how they issue this insurance. It's just wrapped up with the government again. And they obviously have a lot to deal with. And every part of the arts world is obviously facing similar issues. But it's just a shame to see it is moving so slowly. And I hope we get this resolved soon.
Yeah, absolutely. We had John McVeigh actually on the show a few weeks ago, and he was about to go into negotiation or lobbying phase to try and pull this about. So he's obviously been working morning, noon and night to try and get this lined up. I'll perhaps ask him to come back on the show in the next couple of weeks to see how it, you know, what stage we're at. So it's that time of the show where our guests get to nominate their hero of the week and who they're going to be telling to get in the bin. So, Jonathan, coming to you first, who's your hero of the week?
I would say they're my heroes of the week, which are the range of independent producers in this world who, having faced an environment where can't produce, they've been locked down, they've been locked up, as it were, it's just the creativity, the thinking out the box, the effort they're putting into developing new titles that can be made or produced in the current environment or beyond. I think a real shout out has to go to the sort of positive response that the creative community has made in this environment to continuing and doing what they're doing and doing it even better and more creatively and generating ideas, which a number of them come to me with. And I'm just amazed that, you know, rather than seeing the negative of the world, they've taken this opportunity to come up with new concepts, new development projects, new programming ideas, so that as soon as things unlock, they're back out there. They're back out there producing, they're back out there pitching, and they're already pitching during the lockdown. So, you know, that independent creative community certainly are my heroes of the week at this moment.
So, Ruth, who's your hero of the week?
So for me, my hero of the week is a pint-sized punk. It's a 10-year-old boy called Arlo Lipiat, who has created a music fanzine called Pint-Sized Punk as part of, believe it or not, his homeschooling during COVID times at home. So it's brilliant. He's had interviews with the likes of Manic Street Preachers, Super Furry Animals, and he's got a queue of bands wanting to talk to him. He's sold out of Edition 1. Edition 2 has now got global orders. And I think the key highlight of his fanzine for me is that he is now maintaining a Marmite scale for whether you love or hate Marmite for some of the biggest punk bands in the world, all at the age of 10. So I think it's the fantastic entrepreneurial nature and his boldness to contact his heroes for just a chat and ask if they like Marmite. And the modesty of his brilliance. So fantastic. Good on him,
fantastic.
I say.
Fantastic. Well, I completely agree. And now we're finding that Q magazine, we saw that Q magazine has bitten the dust. And I think we're also finding that the likes of NME and Kerrang and a lot of these Indian metal and rock and punk mags have sort of bitten the dust when they've been part of these huge publishing groups. So maybe Arlo can spike a new... you know, and resurgence in the fanzine market. That would be a good thing. Jonathan, who or what are you telling to get in the bin this week?
Well, for me, as a new business, I find all the tax authorities around the world very frustrating because, you know, what you have to do as a new business is get yourself set up to be able to trade with companies in the US and Germany and around the world. And the tax authorities, who in my mind should be trying to move a little bit faster because, you know, the economies everywhere are a little bit more challenged and we want to be generating business. They just move so slowly. As a new independent business, getting yourself set up to be able to receive the license fees due to you or the income due to you is very difficult because you need to have tax codes in the US or in Germany, all these other places, and everybody just moves so slowly. So it's local tax authorities in this business world.
Local tax authorities going in the bin for Jonathan. Ruth, how about you? Who are you chucking in the bin?
So the bin for me, I think there's a Berlin-based art collective called Plastique Fantastique who have created a sci-fi inspired sort of retro futuristic fishbowl-like helmet that they call right. The Isphere that goes on your head to protect you against the coronavirus. So you sort of get two plastic spheres, a bit probably like a hamster ball,
yeah,
and you clip it around your head to protect you. So I had visions when I saw it of people sitting in Cannes with a straw through a hole in this drinking rosé. And I think for me, that's just got to go in the bin. I love a bit of 1950s sci-fi inspiration, but as a piece of headgear, definitely not for me. So in the bin.
In the bin goes Plastique Fantastique. Okay, that's brilliant. Ruth, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really insightful conversation from two very different distribution businesses, and we look forward to seeing you very soon.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
So once again, it's time for us to go over to Hollywood to speak to Deadline's Peter White. Peter, we missed you last week. How are you doing?
Hey, Justin. I'm good, thank you. I'm nice and rested from a week by the beach.
Well, I'm glad that you're able to get down on the beach there and rest up in time for Emmys, which is
exactly
one of Hollywood's big days on the calendar.
Absolutely. Well, I learned the hard way. They love an awards do over here. So Tuesday morning was Emmy nominations. It was obviously held virtually this year with Leslie Jones hosting the nominations. The big news, I guess, was Netflix. No surprise there, dominating this year. They absolutely swam past HBO with 160 nominees compared to HBO's 107. So that was the thing that we were all watching for. They've been back and forth, those two, over the last few years in terms of who's got the most nominations. They tied for wins a couple of years ago. So yeah, this year, you know, volume played out and they just got more nominations, far more nominations than HBO. But HBO will be slightly buoyed by the fact that Watchmen picked up a lot. It was the biggest show with 26 nominations. So I imagine that will probably do well in September when the actual awards are on. And yeah, we'll see what plays out. Both of those have got shows in the main categories, you know, the categories that people really care about, things like the Outstanding Drama Series category and Outstanding Comedy. You've got, so Netflix have got Stranger Things, Ozark and The Crown. HBO's big hope is Succession. Mandalorian popped up into drama. What's in the comedy? You've got Dead to Me, which is the sort of hot tip alongside Kominsky Method, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and Schitt's Creek, which is going out. So yeah, those two were the two that everyone was watching. And then there was a few others. You know, Apple turned up, Disney Plus turned up, and there were some nods for some of the other streamers like Amazon and Hulu.
Yeah, I thought there was some quite notable omissions on the talent side. Mm. I saw that Daisy Edgar Jones missed out on a nomination for Normal People, whereas Paul Mescal, her opposite number in the show, was nominated for Leading Male.
Yeah, that's a bit of a tough one, isn't it? When essentially those two were leading that show and you give a nod to one and not the other. I think, in fairness to Daisy, the female category was harder than the male category, which is why she lost out. But yeah, one of my colleagues spoke to Lenny Abrahamson and Paul yesterday, who, you know, they were both a bit disappointed, you know, happy for the show and happy for Paul, but, you know, were a little bit surprised that if one got nominated and the other didn't. So yeah, the snubs and surprises is the thing that a lot of people watch out for. Who else? There was a Reese Witherspoon must be a bit gutted. I mean, she can cry into her Oscar, but you know, she had three shows that were up, and she was in Big Little Lies season two. She was in The Morning Show, which picked up a couple of nods everywhere else, and Little Fires Everywhere. So she will probably be feeling the same thing as Daisy. Nicole Kidman didn't get anything. The Better Call Saul team were a little bit surprised. Bob Odenkirk didn't get anything. So yeah, there was a few things like that.
Rhea Seehorn, I was completely expecting her to get a nod.
Completely. It's a really strange phenomenon when that show is always, you know, given the kudos by the Academy voters, you know, it's in that best drama series. But you sort of think, well, hold on, if you think it's that good and the writing gets it and the directing gets it, but that show is essentially made by those two, you know, on-screen performances. So yeah, it is a bit odd. I mean, I won't try and understand the Academy voters. And the same goes for a few other things, you know, like they'll give Curb Your Enthusiasm the comedy nod, but, you know, Larry David's nowhere to be seen. A few people were a bit gutted for Never Have I Ever, which was the Mindy Kaling Netflix comedy, which, you know, incredibly diverse cast, a bit of a different story, didn't get anything. You know, there'll be gripes all over the place, but there's a few positives. Zendaya, who was the star of Euphoria, which, you know, was on so long ago I'd almost forgotten about it, that HBO show, popped up. What We Do in the Shadows got a nod, which I don't think too many people were expecting. So yeah, the snubs and surprises is a big part of this, but some will be happier than others.
Yeah. And how about Brits and European nominations? So what are the highlights there?
Didn't do as well as last year, Justin. I don't know what's been going on since I left. You obviously had Fleabag. You had Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who was the queen of the town last year, and Chernobyl. That was a big show for the Emmys last year. You know, there wasn't really anything of that same ilk. And similarly, Bodyguard made it into the best drama series last year. You know, the first time a BBC show had done that in over 50 years. So, you know, you've got things like The Crown are still in there and Killing Eve, which, you know, most people still think of as a British show, even though it was commissioned by a US broadcaster. But, you know, I guess Normal People, although I'm very careful to say I think that's an Irish drama rather than a British drama. Nothing for Queers, nothing for Sex Education. But the other big Brit over here in Hollywood that lost out was James Corden. There was a bit of a peculiar rule change this year that dictated the number of entries in certain categories. So for some of the slightly smaller categories like the late night talk shows or the sketch shows, they actually decreased the number of nominations. So last year, Corden's Late Late Show was up there alongside The Daily Show and Jimmy Kimmel and John Oliver on Last Week Tonight, but he's missed out. So that's a bit of a blow for him. It's a bit of a surprise. He campaigns and he's very well liked amongst Academy voters. But I think on the whole, these voters are rather conservative, as you can tell. Across the board, they stick with who they like. And I think James is probably still considered the newcomer, so which is probably why he's lost out in that.
Michael Douglas, who you interviewed on his Emmy For Your Consideration tour, if you like, did he get nominated?
He did, yeah. Michael's in there, my old pal Mike, alongside his co-star Alan Arkin, and the Kominsky Method's been nommed for Outstanding Comedy Series as well. So I spoke to Chuck Lorre actually yesterday. He was very pleased. So Chuck has been up for that category a few times with the Big Bang Theory, a few chances at bat, as he said, but he never won. So no, I think there's some hope. Whether it's this year, the Emmy Academy voters tend to like things on their final season, as you saw on Game of Thrones last year. I think what you might see with Schitt's Creek this year. So given that Kominsky Method has got one more season to go, which he's currently writing, no idea when they'll shoot that. I actually wonder whether Michael and Alan and the show might get something next year rather than this year. The other one that I thought was interesting that everyone was talking about yesterday was Quibi. You know, slammed in the press, and obviously has been not necessarily been the success that Jeffrey Katzenberg would have hoped. Got 10 nominations. They'll be relatively pleased with sort of nods for things like Dummy and Reno 911. They didn't hit into any of the main categories, but 10 noms on your first go out is not too bad for the quick bites.
Hopefully that'll give them something to smile about. Obviously, they've got lots of work to do to try and make Quibi a success that they were originally hoping it could be. But yeah, let's see what the next few months brings for them. Peter, thank you so much for giving us that overview on the Emmy nominations. When are actually the awards take place?
September 20th, Jimmy Kimmel hosting, very much likely to be a virtual ceremony. I don't think they've officially announced that, but that's where it certainly looks like. I can't imagine that too many of these stars congregating in a ballroom in LA anytime soon.
I expect not. But okay, well, I'm sure there's going to be lots of conversations that we'll have in the run-up to that as well, and get your top tips for who you think's going to be the main winners and losers for that. Peter, thank you so much. Have a fantastic week, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, Justin.
So once again, we get to go over to Riga to speak to our very own content clairvoyant, K7 Media's Gert Sleesis.
hello, Justin. I'm very well. I can't believe that I think it's our last time in July. Next week, it's August already, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I've seen the news this week. The air bridge is open to Latvia.
Yes, yeah. So probably soon you will hear my plane landing in London.
Okay. This week, Gert, we're talking about distribution. We've obviously seen a whole load of changes in distribution. We spoke to Ruth and Jonathan earlier on, two very different types of distribution business. So we've seen a lot of changes in the space, and the roles of distributors have changed as well in recent years.
Absolutely, absolutely. The role of distributors has been constantly evolving in recent years. And it's so not enough to be a distributor in a traditional sense anymore. I think there is much less fat cat-like behavior, even if you are big, well-established, with deep pockets and the biggest of catalogs. The competition has become just so fierce on all levels that it's keeping everyone on their toes. So it looks like a future distributor is someone really flexible, a full-service agency, and partner to producers as well as buyers, getting involved increasingly early in a project, even before it's been pitched, and adding value at every stage of it, from concept and development to matchmaking and creating the best production partnerships, and also modeling the best appropriate distribution strategy in each individual case. It also means that smart distributors are increasingly looking to hire people with strong editorial judgment who have the guts to make these right decisions. And the co-production model has become like the rule rather than exception nowadays, because everyone is trying to mitigate the investment risk. And I think this trend will continue to grow post-COVID as well. Putting together a co-production doesn't necessarily mean jetting around the globe these days. It's a mixed economy. As a seller, you need to be prepared that not every project will be recouped. Investment in unscripted usually is making returns pretty quickly, whereas with scripted, you might have to wait for second or third season, and so on. While the bigger players, particularly those operating both production and distribution business units, seem better geared up for this challenge, the smaller distributors can be found more attractive by those producers and other indies who are looking for more attentive and bespoke service. So there are pros and cons in each scenario. With a big distributor as a creator or producer, you can get attached to that big name where the brand sells itself. You go there because there is a prestigious lineup. But on the downside, it doesn't necessarily mean people selling your product will have seen it at all, because how can they watch so many thousands of hours? When you go with a smaller player, you can be almost certain that those selling watch all the content and are passionate about all their shows because they must work hard to sell it. And we are also seeing that it's not necessarily crucial for a distributor to be an all-rounder. There's definitely enough space for smaller niche players if they follow a very clear strategy, if they have a clear USP, whether it's focusing on a special genre or pushing programming created in a specific country or region or being known for representing new voices, anything that clearly differentiates them from the rest. Among the biggest challenges for distributors in recent years have become global rights acquisition deals and the rise of direct-to-consumer services. And there is also much more bundling. According to Omdia, already almost two-thirds of the buyers are now buying both linear and online rights bundled together. And in the sports rights scene, on the contrary, I think we are increasingly going to see the rights being distributed in a more focused way by major sports organizations themselves, making more smaller deals and increasingly with digital players rather than cable.
So is that current trend of everyone trying to keep their own IP to themselves bringing more threats or opportunities?
I tend to see opportunities in every situation, and this one is no exception. If someone like Disney or Warner withdraws their shows from a platform, it frees up space for something else. It's an opportunity for independent rights holders to sell their IP where they didn't have a chance to squeeze in before. Those broadcasters will need a new source of programming. And by the way, holding to one's own IP is also not something that can change overnight or something that is justifiable at any cost. Interestingly, according to Omdia, 55% of distributors think that the studios will no longer release any of their premium content to third parties. But I must say that, for instance, just to compensate the possible revenue loss from all the deals which Disney has had with third parties in UK alone so far, if they decide to get rid of them, would require Disney to sign up around 10 million paying customers on their subscription service. I trust these big brands know what they are doing, but sometimes it feels they might be maybe too self-centered to see the reality around them. I personally wouldn't be so sure, for instance, that just bringing friends or office to their own platforms will instantly bring the success with it. Because let's not forget that The Office, for instance, actually grew so big only on Netflix. It was never a big show on NBC before. Or let's say Harry Potter. I doubt that there are a lot of people outside the industry who actually know that this is a Warner franchise. And let's be honest, they probably even don't care. They just like to watch these movies.
And how about online distribution platforms? Are they thriving during the lockdown? Presumably they are.
I think that similarly to Disney Plus launch in Europe, the pandemic provided a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for online platforms. It is no doubt the best time to show and to try the advantages of such business model. So coming out of the current crisis, we should see quite clearly, I think, if it was enough to break the inertia and biases from both sides, buyers as well as sellers. The idea of aggregation of program catalogs in one place is great, I think, in the same way as we as viewers would like to find in one place all the programming that we love to watch. The first problems start, however, with integration of content management systems between these platforms and distributors. Having up-to-date avails is crucial to run any further business there. But then, at the next step, I think it might be distributors who are more difficult to be sold on all this whole idea. As in most cases, it would disrupt the way they make the most of their money so far by packaging. Because online distribution gives a way to cherry-picking shows rather than negotiating content packages. So there are two online distribution strategies where I can see a value. One is when it facilitates buyer-seller matchmaking, but then these two continue doing business face-to-face. Or it's a complementary revenue stream for distributors, helping to extract more value from their programming by assisting to handle those clients, particularly the smaller clients in each territory, or those from smaller and poorer markets, where sometimes the amount of revenue from a contract might not even cover the expenses carried by a face-to-face deal-making. Another thing, a definite added value such platforms could bring to the sellers is the data, of course, as if their online client base is diverse enough to provide a reliable source of information, these platforms could be able to provide an invaluable source and insight into buyers' habits.
Perhaps we might see a mixed model developing where you have digital distribution for a certain number of territories, almost that long tail of sales, if you like, whereas the sales teams really focus on the main, really important high-value titles. Do you see that as something that could develop from this?
It sounds like the chrestomatic 80-20 business rule, about the same in TV distribution industry, where maybe these 20% of smaller deals could be done in this way.
Is there anything that has changed in distribution during COVID?
At the start of pandemic, some distributors were almost like clapping in excitement that now with these pipelines of originals drying up, broadcasters will definitely run to them and buy out the whole catalog, including the shows that they hadn't been interested to acquire so far. And I think in most cases, that's not what happened. The crisis doesn't seem to have lowered the standards of buyers in terms of program quality they are looking for. They are still looking for shows that fit their bill, their schedules, or platform profiles. What I think is lacking, though, and perhaps COVID was a good timing to finally tackle it, is a broader research involving normal people, particularly younger viewers, and hearing out their honest opinion, what and how they see themselves watching something in the future. Because sometimes I feel like on a personal level, from time to time, we speak out about our own kids or youngsters we know. And even then, it's kind of in a shy way, in disbelief, what I have found so exciting in TikTok, for instance. But I think that on a professional level, we are still too scared to face it. We live in our comfortable professional industry bubble of like-minded people discussing the future of high-end drama and other big-budget commissions in ever-increasing volumes. But one day in the future, we may just wake up finding out the crowd watching those being much smaller than we expected.
And looking to the future in terms of the content that consumers are going to be watching in maybe 5 years, is perhaps, you know, not really what we're considering right now. It's just about what's buying and selling and what's happening in the moment, as opposed to what's going to be going on in the future.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, that we can be short-sighted quite often.
Food for thought. Gertz, fantastic. Thank you very much for your look at distribution. Really interesting points there, as ever. It's producers next week we're going to be looking at. So that's going to be great to hear from them about the challenges they've overcome during COVID, of which there are obviously many ongoing, but also I'm sure there's some really good stories we'll be able to tell about how they're getting through these adverse times through creativity and doing things in a different way. Well, that's about it for another week's show. As ever, thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the show and share it with friends and colleagues. If you want to hear about our advertising and sponsorship packages, please email me at justin@boomdialogue.com. That's justin@boomdialogue.com. Telecast was edited by Ian Chambers. Next week, we've got a producer special, and we'll be hearing about the challenges they've been facing and how they're fighting through the pandemic. So, tune in again next week, and in the meantime, stay safe.